And to introduce our speaker this evening, the president of PECUN, Oregon's Farm Worker Union, Ramon Ramirez.
Si se puede, si se puede, si se puede.
It's a real honor for me to introduce Dolores Huerta. I personally met her when I was 16 years old, as we organized a march from the high school I went to, and we marched to Safeway there. And it was the words of Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez that their words of justice, the words of building a better life for farm workers really attracted me to dedicate my life to the farm worker movement, not only in Oregon, but in America and internationally. Dolores Huerta and PECUN go a long way. She was our keynote speaker at our second convention back in 1986. And she was a real source of inspiration for us. Recently, a mutual friend of ours who was an organizer with Cesar Chavez and Dolores passed away, Pancho Botello, may he rest in peace, used to talk to us about how it was working with Dolores, how it was organizing with Dolores, because organizing farm workers is one of the hardest jobs in the labor movement, because we're working with a labor force that has never been organized. You know that saying is let's organize the unorganized. They were organizing the never organized. People had never been organized, and it was difficult because the opposition was very strong. And he would tell us stories of the tenacity that Dolores had to confront the situations and be a source of inspiration for farm workers who feared for their lives and who put their lives on the line so that farm workers can get a fair deal. In 1986, we were called to be part of Dolores Huerta's army to go to Washington, D.C. And lobby for the Immigration Reform Control Act of 1986. And I was part of that army. And I remember that we had an office in Senator Ted Kennedy's office, and we had an office in Howard Berman, Representative Howard Berman's office. And this person was fearless. We walked in and out of congressional offices, and she would lay it on the line. She says, hey, these people are putting food on the table, the American people, they deserve to live decently. And she was fearless, man, and she convinced a lot of people. In fact, in 1986, she convinced the U.S. Congress to give a million farm workers legalization, amnesty, in addition to the amnesty of 1986. But she didn't stop there. Dolores single-handedly with Cesar Chavez fought for the labor standards that exist in the current H-2A guest worker program that has made it difficult for growers to use the bring back the old Bracero program. And it was those labor standards that made a difference. And she fought tooth and nail to make sure that those labor standards were included, that the farm workers, if they were going to come as guest workers, get paid a fair wage, that they lived in decent housing, and that domestic workers had a fair shot at those jobs. And it was the work that she did. And throughout the years, we have enjoyed a very, very close relationship. And I want to thank you, Dolores, on behalf of PECUN, its members, its board of directors, its staff, and the farm worker movement that we created here in the state of Oregon. I want to thank you for being a source of inspiration, for your courage to stand up, to defend farm worker rights, to defend immigrant rights. Your example is a source of inspiration for us, is actually what guides us in our work, in this difficult work, as we try to legalize the 12 to 19 million people that are living in the shadows in America today. And Dolores Huerta is part of that movement, that growing movement in this country to win a legalization for our brothers and sisters who are undocumented. And we know and we are convinced that we will win, because even though it's a long fight, it's been a long fight, you know, justice is on our side. So we want to thank you. The farm worker movement thanks you for being here. So at this time, I want to introduce, in my book, one of America's greatest labor leaders that we've had in our history, Dolores Huerta. Let's welcome her with a farm worker clap.
Thank you very much, Ramon, for the beautiful introduction. And thank all of you for being here. This is just a wonderful, wonderful, incredible audience. And also, what a great, beautiful statement that was made by our Peace Awardee. Let's give her another applause, okay? Put some inspiration. And, hey, Chris, I'm going to send this letter from the governor of Oregon. I'm going to send this to Governor Schwarzenegger. Yeah. You know, I was on the Board of Regents of California. Governor Gray Davis had appointed me. And when my term was up, Governor Schwarzenegger refused to reappoint me to the Board of Regents, okay? So I'm going to send him this as just a gentle reminder. And Ramon was referring to the big campaign that we had in 1986 to get immigration reform, to get legalization. And of course, there was very, Bakun and all of you that helped us on that attempt. It was a very successful attempt. And it was, and I want to remind people that that was during an election year in 1986. So right now, we're really concerned, are we going to be able to get immigration reform during this Congress, which we know is a two-year Congress this year, 2009-2010. And a lot of people are saying, it's an election year, so you're not going to be able to get anything passed. Well, you know what? 1986 was an election year. And I really do believe that we may be able to get an immigration bill, depending on how much work we do between now and then. The one problem that we have is a lot of people are saying, well, Obama needs to give us immigration. You know, it's up to him to give it to us. And I have to just keep reminding people that the president can only sign what comes to his desk. He does not have the votes for the bill. The votes have got to come from the Congress, from the senators and the congressmen. It really means that we're the ones that have to do the work to get the senators and the congressmen to be able to pass an immigration bill. When we had that back in 1986, I remember you had Ron Wyden was a congressman, right? And it was because of the pressure that you put on him from this area that we got him to go along with us. And I kind of want to mention his name again, and I do want to start with this issue before we talk a little bit more about immigration, and that is the whole issue of healthcare reform, which we know is the hot issue right now and what is being debated on in the Congress. And I was in Washington a couple of weeks ago with our Speaker, Nancy Pelosi. We did a press conference with several of the congresswomen from different parts of the United States of America. And you know, the women in the Congress are very, very strong about getting a good health care reform bill. But when we talked to some of the staff of some of the Congress people up there, they said that 85% of the emails and the letters that they're getting are against the public option. This is the government, you know, healthcare plan that would kind of compete with the insurance companies and that we're trying so hard to get. 85%, which means that they're not hearing from our side, you know? They're not getting the emails and the phone calls from our side that are saying, we need the public option to be able to compete with the insurance companies. That's really important. And so I just want to ask all of you, if you have not contacted Ron Wyden, Senator Wyden, you know, it's important that you contact him and also your congressman, Mr. Schrader, and say to them, we need the public option, right? I'm sure. I'm sure that if all of us that are in this room tonight, tomorrow, you know, we go to our telephones or we go to our computers and we send that email and say, it's, you know, it's imperative, we demand that you vote for the public option, that they're going to pay attention. And not only should we do it, but we should get five or six other people to do it. With our congressman, we have one of those blue dog congressmen down there, you know? I call them yellow dogs, right? They shouldn't be called blue dogs because, you know, in the labor movement, if somebody signs what they call a yellow dog contract, that means that somebody's doing more for the employer than they are for the workers. So these so-called blue dog Democrats, what they're doing is really harmful because by their opposition, and there's only like 23 of them, I think, in the House right now, of representatives, but what they're doing, what they're holding back and they're fooling around, is that they're really giving the insurance companies more leverage to weaken the national health care bill. That's what they're doing. And so we've got to tell them to cut it out and stop it and represent the constituents and give us that public option that we need. And, you know, one of the conferences that we had in D.C. was a women's conference. And during that women's conference and also during Pelosi's press conference that she did, it was pointed out that women, can you imagine this? Many insurance companies, if you have had a baby, that is considered a pre-existing condition. And if you are a victim of domestic violence, that is considered a pre-existing condition. So that means that these insurance companies, they actually charge women for health insurance 50 to 70% more than they do men, right? And this kind of shows why we really can't trust the insurance companies and why we need that public option. And, you know, it is ridiculous when you think that we in the United States are the only developed country in the world that does not have national health care. And we pay three times more than anybody else does. I went to Spain to a union convention to speak. And the taxi driver that picked us up at the airport, he said, what's the matter with you people in the United States? He says, I'm a cab driver. And I and my entire family are covered with health insurance from our government. So that shows you how far behind we are, right? To think that we are the only developed country that does not have national health care. And the thing is that if we don't get it this time, we probably will never get it for a long, long time to come. So, and the thing is, it's in our hands, right? It's in our hands. We're the ones that have to do the work because the leadership is there with us, and it's only up to us to do the work. And while I'm talking about the women's issue, I just want to throw this in also, that among the many bills that are going to be considered in the Congress this year, one of them that will be considered is in the Senate to ratify the treaty that is, this is a treaty in the United Nations, and what this treaty would do, it would ratify the UN Convention to end the discrimination against women. Who knew that we hadn't ratified that, you know? That again, you know, this is kind of embarrassing that the United States is in the company of countries like Somalia and Sudan and Iran because they have not ratified this treaty that would end discrimination against women. I guess most of us in the room probably thought, well, that probably happened a long time ago. But no, here we are in the year 2009, and it hasn't been ratified. And it's going to need a two-thirds vote of the Senate to be able to get that bill passed. So that's another one that we're going to have to really get to our senators on to make sure that they do that. I really do believe, and I want to just make a pitch in terms of the women's movement, in terms of the feminist movement, that we definitely need to get more women elected to office, okay? And when I say, when we think about how many women representatives that we have in the United States, we only have 17% of our Congress are women. Now, we're supposed to be, you know, the most progressive country, one of the richest countries in the world, right? 17%. In terms of the entire world, We are number 80 in the world in terms of representation of women. And when we think of people of color, of course, you know, that statistic is even worse. And so that means that we've got to change something about that. And if we keep going at the rate we're going right now, it'll take us about 200 years, right, to catch up. And I don't think we're willing to wait that long. And we have to ask, well, why is that? Well, is it because maybe women don't think that they're qualified to run? And that might be part of the problem, right? They actually did a survey in one of the Eastern colleges, and they asked a group of male students if they thought they were qualified to run for office. The male students said yes. 85% of them said they were qualified to run. And when they asked the same question of the female students, only 30%. Only 30% of the women thought that they were qualified to run. So, you know, why is that happening? What is it about the way that we raise our women that women do not have that self-confidence to think that they can be the leaders of the free world? Well, I think we have to look at the way we raise our women. First of all, from the time that women are little girls, what are we told? Don't go out there and get that white dress dirty. Are you climbing the tree? You might fall down and hurt yourself, right? Are you wrestling with your brother or your sister? That isn't ladylike. And then women are told from the time they're little girls, don't worry, somebody's going to take care of you. Somebody's going to protect you. Somebody's going to support you. And then Walt Disney comes along, okay? Walt Disney comes along, and we have Sleeping Beauty, and we have Snow White, and then women are told, well, don't worry about a thing. Prince Charming is going to come, and he's going to give you a big kiss, and he's going to wake you up, and you're going to sleep, and you're going to live happily ever after, right? And instead, what happens, maybe a pretender Prince Charming will come, and he will give you a kiss, put you to sleep. There goes your schooling. There goes your career. And then baby's daddy's gone. And then, of course, as you get older, you might get traded in for a trophy wife, right? A younger model. Okay, so that really means that we've got to look at the way that we educate our women. Because, you know, if we think about the animal kingdom, and we ask, who are the most ferocious in the animal kingdom, the male species or the female? What is our answer? The female. Hey, well, we're part of that kingdom, right? We're the human side of the animal kingdom. So we really have to start thinking about the way that we raise our women. The way that we raise our girls. We've got to change all of our educational systems so that our women can be raised to be strong and to be leaders. Because even as we're talking about this right now, we are sitting here and somebody out there, they think they own that woman's body, right? A woman is getting beaten, a woman is getting raped, a woman is getting killed because somebody thought they own that woman's body. And so that means that we also have to include the whole issue of self-defense, right? Women have to learn how to defend themselves physically, and because really, if we cannot defend ourselves physically, we cannot defend ourselves psychologically, we can be dominated, and we can be manipulated, and then we end up doing what somebody else wants us to do instead of what we want to do for our lives. And women's right to choose, and I'm saying this as a Catholic mother of 11 children, okay? That... That, you know, women, first of all, women cannot even think in terms of their own careers, you know, of their own education, unless they can at least say, I have control over my own body. So that nobody should have the right to tell a woman what she needs to do with her body or how many children she wants to have. I chose to have 11. I don't think many women in the room want to have 11 kids. Once in a while I ask that, who wants to have 11 children? A couple of guys will raise their hands, right? But you rarely see women doing that, okay? And the reason also that I'm raising this is because when we talk about the immigration issue, you know, the same people that attack women's right to choose, you know, Rush Limbaugh, the people that call women femi-Nazis, right? The same people that attack us, the same people that attack people who want equality marriage, you know, these are the same people that are attacking our immigrants. You know, on the equality marriage issue, again, you know, Benito Juarez, who was a great president of Mexico, he was the first indigenous president of Mexico. And he had a great saying that I think every Latino family knows. And his saying was, and I'll say it in Spanish, el respeto al derecho ajeno es la paz. con individuos y con naciones. His saying was, and we talk about peace, Benito Juarez said, the respecting other people's rights is peace, as individuals or in nations, right? So if somebody wants to marry somebody of the same sex, does it really affect us in any way, shape, or form? No, it doesn't, does it, right? So we should say, so who people, you know, whom people want to marry or live with or love, you know, that is their human right. It is a human right. And, you know, something that, again, even in our, you know, many communities that we have a lot of homophobia. And a lot of people don't know this, but do you remember when they killed Matthew Shepard in Wyoming? This little young man, he only weighed like about 100 pounds, and these people went to this, they went and they got Matthew Shepard, and they bludgeoned him with a gun, and then they tied him to a fence to die and left him there to die. Well, the young men that killed Matthew Shepard, after they killed Matthew Shepard, they went downtown because they were looking for a Mexican to kill. And there were two young Mexican young men that were walking down the street, and they attacked him. They attacked him. And they got one of them, and they got the same gun that they had bludgeoned Matthew Shepard. They bludgeoned this young Mexican-American kid, okay? But these guys fought back. You know, they were stronger, and they fought back, so they weren't able to kill them. But because the hair of the young Mexican kid was on that gun, and they could identify who they were, and Matthew Shepard's hair was on that same gun, they were able to identify the killers. A lot of people don't know that. So these hate organizations that attack people who are gay or women's right to abortion, and they are also the same ones that are attacking immigrants. We have to understand that this is all the same group of people. There are hate organizations. And these hate organizations have sprung up, and they're even more numerous now, especially with Obama, our president being an African American. And so we've got to be aware of this, and we've got to stick up for people who are gay, for women who have the right to choose, and of course, for immigrants. And they're all over the place. In fact, one of the people from the Ku Klux Klan had a press conference, and this was on CNN. And he said that their membership in the KKK had grown by 65%. And then he said, and now that our membership is stronger, oh, by the way, their membership had grown because of their attacks on immigrants, right? On undocumented immigrants. And then he said, and now that our membership has grown, we're going to continue our campaign against the blacks and the Jews. Against the blacks and the Jews, right? So that's who these people are. And so we've really got to make people understand what the whole immigrant issue is about. First of all, I love to tell audiences I travel, and I remind people, unless you're Native American, your people came from somewhere, right? Your people came from somewhere. Yeah, this is a nation of immigrants, and back in the 1920s, there were actually more foreign nationals in the United States than there were natural-born citizens. And so when we talk about legalization, that's always been the policy of the United States. When we say we want legalization for our undocumented people here in our country, that's not any different than anything that's ever been done. From day one, people have been legalized in the United States, except now they have made it very onerous, they have made it very difficult, and so if somebody's trying to immigrate a husband or a wife or a parent, it could take 10 to 15 years, and they've made it very, very, very difficult to do that. And then the other thing is that what are our undocumented people doing in our country, okay? Well, we all had some food today. I can assure you that some undocumented person was out there picking our food to put on our table, you know? They're cleaning our buildings, building our buildings. They're preparing our food. They're watching our children, taking care of the elderly, the sick, the disabled. They are doing God's work. They're doing honest work out there. This is what they're doing. And then when they say, oh, well, these people are identity thieves, you know, hey, well, you can't work without a Social Security number. So they make up a number or they borrow a number to be able to work. But all of that money, the Social Security contributions that they're, you know, having from their checks, that is going to our Social Security fund. And they're not going to see that money. And some say it's as much as $35 billion. That is holding up our Social Security fund, and they will not be able to get that money back. They pay local taxes, they pay state taxes, they pay federal taxes. Then the other question that people ask, well, why do people come here? Why do they leave their beautiful homes in Chiapas and in Oaxaca and Guatemala, you know, places that we go to as tourists? Well, because there's no opportunity and there's no jobs. And then we ask, well, why aren't there more opportunities and more jobs? Then we have to look at ourselves in the mirror, the United States of America, because we contribute to that problem. You know, and I'm going to say this so we can understand this. We will remember after World War II, we defeated Japan and Germany, right? We defeated those countries. And then what did we do? We helped them rebuild their economies. So we had a Marshall Plan, and we lent them millions of dollars, and we gave it to their corporations. You know, so you have Sony, Mitsubishi, Honda, all these Japanese companies that became strong. We have Volkswagen in Germany. You know, they used to build the tanks during World War II. Volkswagen did. But we lent them all this money to rebuild their economy. American companies didn't go into Japan or go into Germany. We gave them the money to rebuild their own corporations, okay? And then we said, you don't have to pay us back. Just keep the money. Just keep it, American tax dollars. Now, what's different with our attitude towards Mexico, Central America, South America? American companies go into those countries instead of business, right? Taking out the natural resources, you know, taking out all of the profits, and the people are left behind as low wage earners. And then let's look at the corn, the maíz. That is from Mexico. That is where the corn started, the maíz. Today, Mexico imports more corn from the United States than when it grows in Mexico. So the small campesino farmer in Mexico who hires 10 or 20, 40 people in his little farm, that farmer could not compete with agribusiness from Illinois and Iowa. So where are those million or so campesino farmers from Mexico? They're here in the United States. Those are the undocumented people that we're talking about. So that means that we have to change our foreign policies so that what we should be doing is helping the other countries really rebuild themselves instead of taking over their economies. I call it economic colonization, right? Economic colonization. And this is what we need to do. And this is why the countries in Latin America don't like us, you know? Because somehow, and they feel that the United States feels that all of the resources of the world belong to us. Remember the peace marches when they said about Iraq? How did our oil get under their sand? Remember that one? How did our oil get under their sand, right? And then if those countries don't agree with us, then we don't like them, right? They like Hugo Chavez. You know, they see Hugo Chavez as a dictator because he wanted to continue to run for office like our senators. So that made him a dictator, right? And then Hugo Chavez has a crazy idea, like Mexico. Mexico has the same crazy idea. They believe that the oil that is on their property belongs to them, to their country, not to the oil companies, right? That it belongs to the people, that it belongs to the people. This is what Hugo Chavez believes, right? And so he's using his oil money to create health clinics and to erase illiteracy in his country and to build cooperatives so the people will have work. That's what he's doing with his oil money. Can you think about us in the United States? You know, the billions of dollars that the oil companies have made off of us, and we can't even get them to pay their taxes, right? You know, we can't even get them to pay their taxes. Do you know, again, shows you how backwards we are. We are the only developed country in the world that does not own their natural resources. Think about that. The only developed country in the world that does not own their natural resources. We don't own our oil or our water, our electricity. Other companies own it. That's scary, isn't it? Norway, by the way, has a $400 billion surplus. $400 billion. Norway, this little company, Norway. And you know where their money is from? Their oil. $400 billion surplus, okay? So that shows that we in the United States, that we have a long ways to go and a lot of things that we have to clean up if we're going to be able to really take control of our own country and our own economy. Another issue that I want to mention, could we talk about, you know, the things that we need to do in our country, is that in many ways we are becoming more politically ignorant. You know, And one of the reasons of that is, of course, because our whole public education system is under attack. I want to recommend a book to people. I know a lot of you read. I'm sure some of you have already read this book. It's called The Shock Doctrine. How many of you have you read that book? There's a few people in the room, okay? I was reading this book, and I had to stop because my blood pressure went up so high. And the thing that really got my blood pressure boiling is because I came to the part in the book, and it's towards the front of the book, where they talk about how these free marketers want to dismantle public education. And we say, how could that possibly be? But then if we look around us and we see what's happening, that's exactly what's happening. When you get the tuition in the college that is so high that people can't afford to go to college, when we see that schools are closing, when we see that we have dropout rates of 50% in our Latino, in our African-American community, when we see that our teachers are disrespected and they're not paid enough, you can get more money if you're a prison guard with a high school education than you can as a teacher, you know? Then it's really, really scary. And when we consider that we do not have an educated public, that is very, very scary. Because then we don't know, we haven't got the information of what's going on. And if we just think about what's happened recently, you know, the war in Iraq. How many people thought, you know, and I'm sure the people in this room didn't, but how many of the people out there, especially the ones that watch Fox News, right, thought that, yes, definitely we should go into Iraq? How many people even understand how the whole economic meltdown happened, right, how we were ripped off by all of these bankers? How many people understand what the mortgage crisis was about? Who would ever think in the United States of America that we would have so many homeless people, right, and so many empty houses at the same time? So this shows that we are... this shows how our government is really not being controlled by the people of the country. The whole thing about education, and there's a Spanish philosopher named José Ortega y Gasset. He wrote a book called The Revolt of the Masses. It's a very small book. It's only 100 pages. I don't even know if it's in print anymore. But his theory in that book, he was an educator in Spain before Franco during the Spanish Republic. And his thesis in that book was, if you do not have an educated public, what you will have is mob rule, right? If you do not have an educated public, you will have mob rule. And this is what is happening to us. Another kind of interesting fact, I was watching this interview by Michael Moore the other day at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. It was on Link Television, I believe, or Free Speech TV, one of those. But anyway, Michael Moore was talking about the newspapers, how all of our newspapers are going down, you know? So many of the newspapers are closing, many of the major newspapers in the country. Many cities only have now one newspaper and maybe, you know, not very much of a newspaper at that. And the reason he was saying, and I'm going to quote Michael Moore, is because of so many of our newspapers have been dependent on advertising and not on news. So many of the news media and publishers and the newspapers have fired so many of the reporters, the people that are supposed to be out there getting the information and bringing it to the public so they will know what's going on. And so, you know, people stop reading the news. Now, interestingly enough, this is not happening in Europe. It's only happening here. In Europe, the newspapers are doing great. And you know what? They don't depend on advertising. Here, our newspapers depend on advertising. So what a situation we have here where our newspapers are going out of business. So where are you going to get your information from, right? Our newspapers are going out of business. And then we have an educational system that is not really teaching people how to think or even teaching people how to read and write. And so that really means that we are contributing to have a whole country of ignorant people that don't know how to think, don't know how to read, don't know how to write, don't know how to question. And it really, really places our democracy in jeopardy. It does. Because if people cannot ask the questions and they can't take the actions, then our whole democracy is at risk. So, you know, these are the things that we have to start thinking about. And I know it's hard because we have so many issues that are on top of us. You know, we got the war issues and the healthcare issue, the energy bill, the immigration bill, all of these things that we have to worry about. But we've got to start looking at what's happening to our educational system. In California, in the San Joaquin Valley, where all of our food is grown, it's about a 300-mile area, there has been only one university built since 1965, University of California, Merced. In that same area, there have been 17 prisons. 17 prisons. And I think you all know this, that we have more people in prison in the United States than any other country. You know, this is a disgrace. So it creates an apartheid system, especially because we know who's in those jails. It's black and it's brown and it's poor white. Those are the people that are in those prisons. In California, our educational budget and our prison budget are almost the same. And like Jesse Jackson says, it costs more money to keep somebody in jail than it does to send them to Yale, right? That's Jesse Jackson's quote. So, you know, I think we were really, really great in the last election. People went out there, they registered to vote, they got people out to vote, everybody's celebrating. You know, we have a new president, the first African-American president in the history of the United States of America. And so we all felt, you know, feel really good about what happened. But, you know, when we talk about nonviolence, and it's kind of interesting in the English language, because non and violence are two negatives, you know? Nonviolence. And the word in the Indian word that Gandhi used for nonviolence was very different. And I may be pronouncing this wrong. I'm sure somebody in the audience will correct me. But the Indian word is ahimsa, something like that. And the interesting thing about the Indian word is that it is not a passive word. Ahimsa is a positive word. It's something that you've got to do something, right? Nonviolence sort of mean, it kind of indicates a little passivity that we don't have to do very much. But the Indian word, the way Gandhi interpreted, means that we had to take action, that we actually had to do something, right? And so I think this is where we're at right now in our country. We, you know, had a great election. People registered to vote. As I said, they voted. But you know what? The other part is missing, the advocacy part, the organizing part. That's got to be part of it. We just can't say, I'm going to vote, and then I'm going to walk away, and I'm not going to see what our politicians are doing. You know, Cesar Chavez used to say, with politicians, you've got to keep your eye on them, because they're like batteries. You know, their batteries run out after 2 years, right? So we've got to remember that, because in Washington and up here at the Capitol here in Oregon, those lobbyists are there. These, you know, lobbyists with all of their money trying to buy politicians. They're there all the time. They're on top of them. So the only way that we can counteract that is with our votes and our voices. You know, we've got to make our voices heard. We've got to make our votes heard. And we've got to be able to take some of those politicians out if they don't act the right way, even if they're Democrats, okay? Even if they're Democrats, we have to take them out. And we've also got to work for public finance reform, all right? So in Arizona right now, they do have public finance reform so that some of you that are here in this audience can start running for office, all right? You know, so you don't have to be a millionaire to run for office. We've got to think about that. And the only way we can do that is if we get public finance reform. That's got to be a must. And again, when we have our candidates forums and we talk to our politicians, that's one of the things that we want them to vote on. I want to talk a little bit about what I'm doing with my foundation. I started a foundation. I left the Farm Workers Union about 5 years ago. And one of the reasons that I did that is because, again, in our immigrant communities, we have a lot of people that come in. They don't know what their rights are, but they also don't know what their responsibilities are. So we started raising money and hiring organizers and training them and sending them into these immigrant communities so they could start doing house meetings with people and teaching them how to work together and how to organize. And we've had some very, very tremendous victories. You know, we've been able to get just a couple of examples. You know, we're down in Southern Kern County. The temperature goes up there to 109 degrees in the summer. Our kids had no swimming pools at all. Even though we had over 100 days that were very, very hot, these kids had no swimming pools. So now we have 2 swimming pools for our children in that area. We've got youth programs where we send the kids camping. We've got leadership programs. We've just had 27 homes that have no kind of sewer drainage. We were able to get funding from the Department of Agriculture, our local supervisor, and we got these 27 homes now that are going to be hooked up to a sewer drain, and it's only going to cost them $50 for each family to hook that up. But the thing that we're doing, I'm just giving you a few examples, is that another one that's a really good one, one of our committees passed a bond issue to get a gymnasium built at their middle school. And the great thing about this is that they do all the work. We don't do the work. We just train the organizers, get the people together, and then they get together and do what they have to do. So it's just teaching people, the way that Cesar and I organize, is teaching people that they have power, right? Because people used to ask us, how are you going to organize the farm workers? You know, they're poor, they don't have any assets, they don't have any money, they don't speak the English language. How are you ever going to organize the farm workers? They say, the way that we organize them is we say to the workers, you know what, you have power. You have power. You don't have to have money. You don't have to have assets. Your power is in your person. And when you get together with other workers, and then you form an organization, and then you take direct action, this is the way that you make the changes. Recently, there's a fellow who's making a movie about farm worker youth. And he made the statement that farm workers didn't have the power to change their own lives. And I had to disagree with him, because everything that we want for farm workers, like getting unemployment insurance, getting rid of the short handle hole, getting the laws to get farm workers the right to organize, the farm workers did it themselves. They're the ones that did the marches. They're the ones that registered people to vote. They worked on political campaigns, got good people elected, you know, marched all the way to Sacramento to put the pressure on the politicians. And so they did the work. And so I think that's the example that we have, right? That just like the farm workers did it, the rest of us can do it. We used to have a saying in the union, cada trabajador es un organizador. Every worker is an organizer. Well, you know what? Each of us has to be an organizer. Each one of us can use our personal power to get out there, organize other people to make these changes that we need. Because if we don't do it, no one else is going to do it. And I know that this audience knows this because you've been doing it for a long time. The farm workers never would have gotten toilets in the fields if you, all of you, wouldn't have gone out there and picketed and boycotted the grapes and all of that. You know, farm workers still would be out there the way they were before. So we do have it in our power to make the changes that we need to make. And all we have to do is get out there and do it and organize other people. And the other thing, too, I think all of us in the movement, say the immigrant rights movement, the women's movement, the peace movement, you know, we just kind of talk to each other, right? But we've got to go out there and talk to those other people that are not with us. You know, that's why I say all of us have to become organizers. And then we've got to come together on the different movements. The immigrant rights movement needs the peace movement, right? We need the peace movement to support the farm workers so we can get legalization. Yeah, because we are the majority. When you come right down to it, women, okay? People of color, white men of conscience, you know? We are the majority, right? So, you know, we can't afford to sit back. And, you know, next year, I'm going to be 80 years old next year, by the way, everybody. I want to be 80 years old next year, and I'm going to be asking everybody to do virtual birthday parties for my foundation so that we can, right now we're organizing in 7 different farm worker communities. You know, we've only been operating for 5 years. We're already up to 20 staff people in our organization. And as we can raise more money right away, we hire more organizers, we train them, and we send them into these farm worker communities to get the people together to start taking care of their issues, you know. So I'm going to ask everybody to help me celebrate my birthday by helping us raise funds. And by the way, I just want to make it clear, I do not take any money from the foundation, and I'll tell you why, and I think you'll like the story. You know, in 1988, Cesar Chavez did a 36-day fast for the issue of the pesticides, because, you know, so many farm worker children were dying of cancer from the poisons that they put on our food. And after Cesar did his fast, he went off to recuperate from his fast. I went off and we started doing the boycott of grapes again, the third grape boycott in San Francisco. Well, during that demonstration, we were demonstrating against George Walker Bush, who was running for the president. And he had had a press conference and he said, there's nothing wrong with the grapes, you know? With the pesticides. He says, there's nothing wrong with the pesticides. Our government is taking care of us. You know, you don't have to worry about it. And so we were picketing him in San Francisco for saying that. Well, during the course of that demonstration, and it was a big demonstration. This is, of course, when the United States was dropping bombs in El Salvador, and we had the wars in Nicaragua. And so a lot of people were out there demonstrating. They had big poster boards that said, Bush Noriega. Remember Noriega from Panama? Yeah, okay. Bush Noriega, that's the ticket, right? And then, and there was, of course, being San Francisco, we had a large contingent of the gay movement out there. And many people were out there and they were in drag. And so they were carrying around signs that said, Bush is a drag. Which we, of course, we all knew that. Well, during the course of that demonstration, the police came in and started beating people up. And I was one of the victims of that assault, you know. And so they actually, you know, hit me so hard that my spleen, they never found it, it splattered. And they broke my ribs. I almost died because I lost so much blood. But again, as the saying in Spanish says, no hay nada mal que algo bien no salga, no. There's nothing bad that something good doesn't come out of it. We sued the city of San Francisco, okay? So because of that, and in the farm worker movement, you know, we never got paid. We only worked for $10 a week. Our food came from donations. Our clothes came from donations. And so because of that lawsuit, now the city of San Francisco has to give me $2,000 a month till I die. So I can continue to work, and then the money that we raise, as I say, goes towards the foundation to hire organizers to train them. And so anyway, I hope that some of you can help us celebrate. We want to do some webcasts. When we do that, we'll keep in touch with people here so that they'll know what's going on. One other thing I want to mention, that there's a movie called Viva la Causa. It's a docudrama, and it was made by the Southern Poverty Law Center. It's available for teachers to get that, and part of it has a beautiful section of Robert Kennedy in that movie. And for those of you, and I know people here that love Robert Kennedy, I want to tell you that in Los Angeles, where Robert Kennedy was killed at the Ambassador Hotel a week ago Saturday, we are dedicating the new Robert F. Kennedy School. Three grammar schools, a middle school, and a high school are right there. And we had to beat Donald Trump to get that because he wanted that land for a Trump Tower, okay? So I'm going to say one more thing, and then we're going to have, I think, maybe time for some questions. I don't know if I've gone on too long. But I just want to say this. Look, we got to end the racism. You know, like I said, our poor President Obama is now being threatened. They've been making all these horrible jokes about him. And, you know, what is the name of our human race? Somebody tell me. Our human race. We only have one human race. What's our name, our scientific name? Homo sapien. We all know this, right? Where did our human race begin? Africa. Our human race went across the planet. They, you know, they went to Asia, got lighter in skin, came down to the Bering Strait to the Americas. One of our tribes got lost. They went way up north where it's really cold and they got really white. Now they have to go to the beach or the tanning salon to get their color back, right? But the thing is that we are all one human race. We are all Africans of different shades and colors. So we can say to the Aryan Nation, the White Citizens Council, you know, the KKK, the Minutemen, we could say to all of them, get over it, you're Africans. Get over it, okay? So I want you to join me. I want to say this word. It's a Zulu word from South Africa, and it means the people are coming together to fight for justice. And for us, we're going to say the people are coming together to fight for peace and justice. The word is Wozani. Can you say that word? Wozani. Okay, let's all shout that word together. I'll say 1, 2, 3. Let's say it so loud so that the racists, the bigots, the homophobes, the sexists, the ageists, right? All of those, so they can hear us. So I'm going to say 1, 2, 3. Let's all shout Wozani at the top of our lungs. 1, 2, 3. Wozani! That was awesome. Okay? Thank you.